Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Creedal. It is Holy Week. It is now Friday of Easter week, or as the Eastern Catholics call it, Bright Week. We are in the Easter octave still. This is a Friday when you can eat meat, and I hope that you're doing that if you are a Catholic and otherwise would be abstaining from meat on Friday. So this Easter week really is my favorite week of the entire year. Easter is my favorite holiday. Many people, and especially when I was a kid, I loved Christmas because that's when I got all the presents, but I really love Easter because it allows us to dive into the Paschal mystery in a really full way. Christ is alive. He is really, truly alive. And when I say that, I don't mean it in the way that many people mean it today in a sort of ethereal or mystical sense. Christ is actually physically alive as well. I think the proof for the physical resurrection is very strong, and I've done a podcast episode on that recently. I'll link to that in the show notes. I also recommend to you the work of William Lane Craig, the Christian philosopher, who's done a lot of work on the physical resurrection. There are a bunch of others too, and I think I cite them in the podcast episode that I did on this, but the proof for the physical resurrection is really strong, and anyone who says that it's not simply hasn't looked at the evidence. It's not to say that you cannot in any way or, you know, argue that Christ did not physically resurrect from the dead, but I do think that the argument that he did is in fact the stronger one. And this is why people like Lee Strobel, who set out to disprove the key tenets of Christianity, most especially the resurrection, often end up being convinced that something happened and the tomb really was empty. So Jesus is in fact alive. Now, interestingly, While he did certainly physically resurrect, we don't hold that his physical resurrection was merely a physical resurrection, or that he simply had his physical body resurrected and it is a facsimile of what it was. We hold that Jesus has a glorified body. And so, yes, it's a physical body. He eats fish with the disciples. He expresses desires for food and drink. He feels desires for food and drink when he's with them, but he's also in a glorified body. He's not held by the tomb, for example. He's not prevented from entering the room with the disciples when they're huddling upstairs in the upper room, and he comes through the doorway even though the door is shut. He passes through the midst of people. He remains concealed. And Benedict XVI has a great passage on this in his final book of the trilogy, Jesus of Nazareth, where he talks about how we see echoes of Jesus's appearances in the post-resurrection accounts. We see, I guess not echoes, foreshadowings of those in the Old Testament theophanies, when God is hidden, but sort of makes himself known in an inner way in the heart of people. Benedict talks about the appearance of our Lord to Abraham by the oaks of Mamre, and how Abraham knows at once within himself that this is the Lord. And so in the same way, when Jesus appears among the disciples, he really is truly physically present with them, but he's also making himself known in an inner way to the inner life of the disciples and the various people to whom he appears along the way. Just in the same way, when he appears to St. Paul on the road to Damascus, he appears only to St. Paul, and to the others who are with him, they're confused. One account says they heard a voice but saw nothing. Others saw a bright light and heard nothing. But the point is that Jesus made himself known to Christ in a mystical, or to Paul in a mystical way. Now, in the same way, faith is a gift. Every bit of faith that we have is a gift from God. So if you're looking for ironclad proof, physical, factual, historical proof of the resurrection, you won't find it. There's plenty of proof for it, but I would not call this proof ironclad. There will always be room for doubt. So faith really is a gift, and it is a grace for us to receive it. So this Easter, if you are a believing Christian, be grateful that you've been given that grace. Be grateful that you've been open to receiving that grace from God. And if you are someone who's struggling with this conviction, this faith, or you're someone who is just simply not convinced by the claims of Christianity, I encourage you to look at it with open eyes. And I encourage you, even if this is new to you, to ask God for the grace to believe, ask God for the gift of faith, which is, of course, not to say that we take anything on blind faith and we expect it to contradict our reason. Never will that be the case. But rather that we declare that the tenets of faith, the deepest realities of our mystical faith, are not wholly accessible to reason. We cannot, for example, understand the complexity and the fullness and the completeness of the Most Holy Trinity using reason alone. Now, even with faith, we can't understand it all, because to understand something is to actually have something fully accessible by reason. And the mysteries of the faith do transcend reason, right? We can approach them with reason, and we can see arguments for their truth and veracity through reason, but faith will always be a gift. So that's my very brief reflection at the beginning of Holy Week. Now on to some exciting things that I have to share with you. One, I've started a newsletter. This newsletter is called The Six, and I will, if you're watching this on YouTube, I'll be sharing my screen here in just a moment as I share with you why exactly I called this The Six and what that all is about. But in the initial initial release of this, I've now done two newsletters. In the initial one, I explained why I decided to call it The Six, and it's kind of fun. There are a couple different things going on here. One, I say this is descriptive, right? Because in each newsletter, I'm trying to pick six different things from around the world of ideas. These could be interesting news articles. These could be interesting YouTube videos, interesting films that I watch, books that I've been reading, etc. And I recommend them to you for your own engagement. I normally offer an extended reflection on at least one of those things and just offer some more of my thoughts. But for each of them, I'll at least offer some sort of summary or prezi. So six is descriptive, first of all. I also just think it sounds cool. But there are some cool things with respect to the number six. If you look this up, if you just go to the Wikipedia entry for six, for example, you'll see a lot of these, not all of them, but it's a perfect number, which means it is a number equal to the sum of its divisors, meaning 3, 2, and 1 are all divisors of the number six. And if you add those up, you, of course, get six. It is the only single digit perfect number, which is kind of cool. It's also it shows up in geometry a lot. We see it showing up in nature, for example, the facets of a bee's honeycomb or the number of faces on a cube. It's the atomic number of carbon, which is, as we remember from elementary biology, the basic building block of all life, at least all human life and the life on Earth. There are good reasons for hypothesizing that there could be other elements that are building blocks for life elsewhere, but on Earth, we generally accept carbon is the basic building block of life. Six colors in the RGB color wheel, 6 days of creation, a creation account that is held to by all the major Abrahamic faiths. And as I mentioned in the newsletter, last but not least, certainly not least, Stan Musial, the great devout Catholic Hall of Fame baseball player, St. Louis Cardinals. I'm a Phillies guy, but I can root for Stan Musial, wore number six for his entire career. So I just like the number six. I think it's a cool name for a newsletter, and this is the new project that I'm launching with this. So as I'm sharing my screen here, if you're watching this on YouTube, you can see this is the first version of the newsletter that I did. I looked at an article called Secularization Comes for the Religion of Technology by a guy named L.M. Sakasis, and I go into depth on this article in the newsletter, and so you can see as I scroll through what exactly the structure of this will look like. So I've got some excerpts from the article. I've got a brief summary of it. I have my own reflections on it. Exactly what this means for the future, et cetera. And I've got a few other recommendations. The most recent newsletter I did was on Holy Week, and the subtitle of it was On Holy Week and the Heroic God-Man. And I use as a launching point for discussion this piece in the recent article of First Things called Suicide of the Radical Right. This is by a guy named Matthew Rose. Matthew helps run an institute, I think it's called the Morningside Institute in New York City. There's an organization called the Foundation for Excellence in Higher Education, FEHE, F-E-H-E, and they run these higher education institutions all across the country at very prestigious institutions like the the Witherspoon Institute at Princeton, the Zephyr Institute at Stanford, the Morningside Institute, which I think serves Columbia in New York City, the Abigail Adams Institute in Boston. And so there are a bunch of these all over the country, and they are designed to be academic centers, but coming alongside major prestigious academic institutions to offer resources and programming for students who are asking intentional questions about the good life and about flourishing and about the history of intellectual conservatism. And these ideas that have really been foundational for so much of Western civilization. So Matthew helps to run the Morningside Institute, and he has this piece in First Things called The Suicide of the Radical Right. And he opens this article by talking about a French critic named Dominique Venner. And he took his own life in front of the Notre Dame Cathedral main altar several years ago in France. And he wrote in a suicide note prior to this, he said, "I sacrifice myself to break the lethargy that has overtaken us. I offer my life as a protest. While so many people are slaves of their lives, my gesture embodies an ethical will. I give death to myself in order to awaken slumbering consciences." Now, Rose makes this point as well, and I go on to explain that you might think that because this person took his own life in front of the altar of Notre Dame Cathedral, that he was a forlorn Catholic, perhaps looked around the world and was just so cynical by the divisions that we see in the church. Maybe he had a crisis of ecclesiology. Maybe he was just so desolate and made so cynical by the events that he saw all around him and decided that he would borrow language from his faith in using the word sacrifice and, you know, commit a self-sacrifice in front of the altar. But Christians don't do self-sacrifice. Christians do martyrdom, and this is, of course, not what that is. And it turns out, when you scratch below the surface, Dominic Venner was certainly not a Christian. Matthew Rose describes him as a pagan, and if you know anything about his writings, he actually was very hostile to Christianity and blamed it for a lot of the ills that he saw present in Europe today. So that's the Dominic Venner introduction to this article, and I really encourage you to read this article because it was fascinating, and I learned a lot in Matthew Rose's work. But I go through this a bit more and talk about exactly what Venner saw. And Venner was, as Matthew Rose said, Venner was a pagan, or we might say a neo-pagan, kind of in the Nietzschean school, but he was also really a devotee of Western civilization. And he spent a lot of time complaining about Western civilization and how far it had come from its starting points. And he held up as the sort of the apotheosis of Western civilization, he held up not the narratives of Christianity, not the heritage of the Judeo-Christian ethic, but rather the Greeks, these ancient civilizations that held to a complex mythology that really elevated heroes. So this sort of heroic mythology was what Venner thought gave life, infused life and power and meaning into Western civilization. And to him, it was Catholicism in particular, and most especially a Dominican friar named Thomas Aquinas, who is responsible for deconstructing all of that, because in his view, Aquinas and the rest of his sort of the Thomistic tradition that built up around him and succeeded him ended up disenchanting the world by sort of trying to rationalize everything, right? Now, that's not fair to Aquinas for a number of reasons, but I don't go into, you know, all the sort of problems with that claim in my brief reflection. I will briefly say here that Thomas was by no means looking to rationalize everything, and as I mentioned at the beginning of this podcast, talking about how we will not find ironclad proof for the physical resurrection, Thomas would say the same thing. Thomas understands that God is not fully accessible to human reason, but that does not mean that he is inaccessible to human reason. And so human reason does point to God, but human reason does not fully explain God, right? To understand the distinction is very important, because we have to recognize that Christianity does not claim, has never claimed, that God is wholly accessible to human reason. We have simply claimed in the Thomistic tradition, and this is not, you know, this is not something that Thomas started, but he really expounded and expanded this claim. We claim that our reason can point to God, right? And we can uncover truths about God using our reason. This is why the church fathers talk about sort of two scriptures. Not to say that, you know, in a hyperbolic sense, but one of those is the actual written word of God that is the divinely inspired word of God. The other is creation that all around us attests to the beauty and grandeur and reality of God. But to Venner, it was the Catholics, and especially the Dominicans following Thomas, who just tried to rationalize everything. And that rationalization led to a disenchantment. Now, I do think that he's at least right in the diagnosis, wrong in the reasons. It's certainly not the case that it was Catholicism that disenchanted the world, because we look at Catholicism today, Catholicism itself is becoming disenchanted, and it's not its own doing, right? This is sort of the zeitgeist of the age. I would point much more to the Industrial Revolution, which kicked off the era of mass production and widespread capitalism, detached, by the way, from the morals that give it staying power and give it legs, that then carried on to its logical conclusion, ends up in this hyper-technologized society in which we find ourselves now, and it's that, in fact, that disenchants us. So now when someone encounters a possible miracle or an actual miracle, their first tendency is to doubt the miracle and say, you know, what technological thing can we do to accomplish this? I've been reading through Exodus with my children, and it's interesting how in the Exodus account, God calls Moses and eventually his brother Aaron, when Moses says he's not up to the task, to go to Pharaoh and work these miracles, right? And Pharaoh His first response is to just have his own magicians come in and replicate it, right? So we can think of the technologists of today as the magicians of Pharaoh, and their task is to replicate the things that were previously unexplained. Now, there's an interesting point around the fourth plague when I think it's the flies or the gnats, when Pharaoh's magicians can't replicate it. So Moses and Aaron have gone in here and they've thrown their staff on the ground and the staff turns into a snake and the magicians can do that. They turn the Nile into blood and Pharaoh's magicians can do that. But eventually they get to a point where the magicians can't replicate it, right? And even so, Pharaoh's heart is hardened and says, basically, I'm not going to listen anyway, right? Even though my own magicians, my own technologists can't replicate this, they're saying this is a miracle. I'm not going to do it. I'm not going to believe. And there is this similar sense of disenchantment that permeates our 21st century today that I think Venner was absolutely right to identify. And this certainly causes problems for us, not just for the church, but across society. I think this has led to an erosion of identity. It has led to an erosion of relationships. It's led to an erosion of the institution of marriage. And the effects of that are far-flung and far-reaching. So I explore this a little bit more, and I encourage you to look at my brief reflection on this to understand what I'm talking about. But my ultimate takeaway from this was that Venner, sadly, was missing the forest for the trees, because he had built up his entire worldview around this worship, this exaltation of the mythic hero, the archetypal hero. And when we look at Christianity, what we actually see is the fulfillment, the ultimate hero, the fulfillment of all those classical archetypes of heroes. Because the fact is, humanity has recognized that it needs a savior, and we have built for ourselves this complex mythology. You can look at the Romans, you can look at the Greeks, you can look at mythology from the Zoroastrians or any number of polytheistic religions around the world, and you can see that there's a complex mythology around these. We have this longing to elevate creatures higher than ourselves, to put them on pedestals, right? And to Venner, that's a good thing because it gives us meaning. One way to look at that is to say that all of these heroes are constructed. All of these archetypes are simply mythologies, and they're mythologies that are not true. Another way to look at that is to say that there actually is something true in these archetypes but demonstrated by the fact that they are so universal and so widespread. It says something that virtually every human civilization up to the birth of Christ had this sort of hero archetype mythology in its lore, in its tradition. Right. And so one way to look at that is just to look at this as sort of an evolutionary outgrowth that can be discarded. Another way to look at that, especially when we do pair this with the robust evidence surrounding Christianity and the physical resurrection in particular, is that all of these are foreshadowings, right? That there's some meta narrative going on here. And Jesus Christ is the fulfillment of that meta narrative, of all of those human expectations that contributed to the elaborate mythologies. Jesus Christ is the fulfillment of that. Now, the other interesting thing about this is that the hero, the God-man who becomes man, he becomes incarnate, he doesn't embrace his heroship in a visible and powerful way. He does not come riding on the clouds in glory with the staff in his hand. He comes in a stable at the incarnation. He takes on flesh, takes on the form of a baby, and that's the hero. And similarly, he's led like a lamb to the slaughter when he's led to the cross. So we actually kill our hero, but that hero is not silenced even by death. That hero rises again, and that hero is our king today. So what Venner saw as a critical weakness in Christianity is actually its greatest insight and greatest contribution. It is that the archetype is, of course, correct. Jesus Christ is the fulfillment of the archetype, but the fulfillment looks very different than we expected. It's exactly why Jesus was not accepted in his day. It's exactly why Jesus is not accepted in our day, even by people like Venner, who have read enough that they should know better. But Jesus Christ is the archetype who fulfills all of these things. In closing on my reflections here in the article, in the newsletter, I talk about how Venner, I'm now summarizing another scholar named Thomas Berenow, Venner held up three important things that a hero needed to have: the dignitas of nobility, the virtus of the citizen, and the devotio, these are Latin terms, of the leader who gives the gift of his person to his country. And I say, where have we heard these things before? It's a lot earlier than Venner. If we look at Eusebius, who is the 3rd century Greek historian, you can see him sort of assigning these three qualities to the tripartite office of Christ. Tripartite meaning three parts. So the dignitas of nobility clearly maps onto Christ's kingship because he comes as a king. We can see that in the Palm Sunday narrative. De virtus of the citizen, that clearly maps on to Jesus coming as a Jew, as a faithful and observant Jew of Israel who came, you know, to the Jews first and then to the Gentiles. He came first for the lost sheep of the house of Israel. And then third, devotio is exemplified by his sacrificial priesthood, which Jesus obviously most fully embodies for us at the Last Supper and as the final Paschal Lamb. So all three of those things, Venner perhaps didn't recognize, but all three of those things are present in the most perfect and full and complete way in the person of Jesus Christ. That is the hero that we worship. So Venner castigated Christianity for destroying this myth of the hero. I look at Christianity as fulfilling the myth of the hero, but doing so in a way that is quite shocking and humbling and calls us not to be served, but to serve. I think that is the amazing thing about Christianity. Among all the other things that it has contributed to the world, it is that, the person of Jesus Christ, the God-man, the hero God-man, who is rejected by those who expected him and rejected by those today who still can't quite believe that the Son of Man would come to serve and not to be served. So anyway, I encourage you to check this out. Check out the article by Matthew Rose as well, and I linked to the other one by Thomas Barrineau. But quite fascinating work of both gentlemen. Venner was a very complicated person who had a lot of bad ideas, but also an incisive ability to diagnose at least a lot of our problems today. Just to give you an idea, I'll share my screen again if you're watching this on YouTube, but in the newsletter, I also talk about this recent article in the New York Magazine by Andrew Huberman. Andrew Huberman's a very popular podcaster. He's often associated with sort of red pill movement. Young men look to him in particular for the Huberman protocols. He talks about the importance of getting sleep and the beneficial effects of nicotine and caffeine and how you should have your caffeine in the afternoon and not in the morning and how you need to maximize your dopamine flow and do all these things to, you know, maximize your gains in the gym, et cetera. And so there are certainly good things that Huberman says. I've watched a few of his videos and find them interesting. He's a neurologist, ophthalmologist at Stanford University. And so he has the credentials to talk through a lot of the things that he does go into at length for his viewers. Really a fascinating guy. He's obviously made millions off of this podcast and the whole Huberman Lab persona. But New York Mag did basically a giant hit piece on him. Talking about how he has had, you know, serial affairs with multiple women. He's unmarried, but has had just serial affairs and has cheated on women that he's been in a committed relationship with, etc. Now, all of this is really unfortunate because so many young men hold this guy up as a model, and we obviously need role models for young men who can show those young men what being in a committed marriage relationship looks like and how being an alpha male is not simply about saying yes to every passion that rules you or every passionate impulse that you feel. And so that's sad that Huberman's not that. I also think it's interesting, however, that New York Magazine clearly wanted to go after this guy because he does have the voice of so many young men who are now skewing conservative in record numbers and really diverging from their women counterparts on the political ideology scale. And it's interesting that New York Mag went after him in this specific regard because it was only in January that they published an entire issue, the cover of which was advertising their key article for that magazine issue, which was all about polyamory, a guide for the curious of polyamory. So New York Mag apparently has sort of recovered their traditional ideals of commitment and marriage, which is a great relief since just in January they published a practical guide to polyamory. I also highlighted this article called The War at Stanford, and I want to share with you a clip from another thing I highlighted in this newsletter called, it's a guy named Jensen Huang. Jensen Huang is one of the most successful businessmen who you've probably never heard of. When people think about valuable companies today, they think about Apple and Microsoft and Facebook and Google, but there's one that is more valuable than some of those that I just mentioned, and enormously successful. It's benefited from two really big developments recently. One is cryptocurrency mining, and the other is artificial intelligence. The thing that both of those things need is vast amounts of compute, and where do we like compute power, right? And where do we get compute power on a little microchip or a graphics processing unit, a GPU? And NVIDIA is this company that has made many of these. So if you have a computer, there's a good chance that there's a good chance that you have an NVIDIA graphics card in it. So what's interesting to me is that I was on Twitter and found this video from Jensen Huang where he's talking about resilience and the importance of it. He's speaking, I think, at a Stanford student event. So there's a Stanford student who asked him a question, basically says, what's your advice for us who are looking to enter the workforce soon? I'm going to play this for you, and you can hear his response, and then we'll talk through it briefly.
One of my great advantages is that I have very low expectations. and I mean that. Most of the Stanford graduates have very high expectations. You deserve to have high expectations because you came from a great school. You were very successful. You're at the top of your class. Obviously, you were able to pay for tuition. And then you're graduating from one of the finest institutions on the planet. You're surrounded by other kids that are just incredible. You naturally have very high expectations. People with very high expectations have very low resilience. And unfortunately, resilience matters in success. I don't know how to teach it to you except for I hope suffering happens to you. And I was fortunate that I grew up with my parents providing a condition for us to be successful on the one hand, but there were plenty of opportunities for setbacks and suffering. And to this day, I use the phrase pain and suffering inside our company with great glee. And the reason, and I mean that, boy, this is going to cause a lot of pain and suffering. And I mean that in a happy way, because you want to refine the character of your company. You want greatness out of them. And greatness is not intelligence. Greatness comes from character, and character is informed out of smart people. It's formed out of people who suffered. And so if I could wish upon you, I don't know how to do it. For all of you Stanford students, I wish upon you ample doses of pain and suffering.
So I think this is fascinating for a number of reasons. There's a bunch of good things in here. One of the things that stood out to me is he says, greatness is not about intelligence, but greatness is about character. That is such a novel position for us to hold today. We often don't talk about character enough. We don't even know what character is. I'm also reading G.K. Chesterton's Heretics right now. And in the first couple chapters, Chesterton talks about how, these sort of Victorian or post-Victorian writers scandalized with their bawdy literature, right? People are sort of delving, they're violating Victorian morals by writing these, horrifically scandal-ridden accounts. And Chesterton says, people get that wrong a lot. What scandalized people is not that they were scandalized by the bad things that were happening, but that there was no holistic account of the good. And he says further that at the fall, in the garden, mankind suffered the first fall. And through that fall, we gained the knowledge of good and evil. Chesterton says, now we've gained a second fall. And through that, we've lost the knowledge of the good. And now we only have the knowledge of the evil. So the problem with so much of our literature and writing today is that we know all about what evil is. And we know all about what the bad stuff is. But we don't have a vision of the good. So we can't really talk about what character is. We can talk about what character isn't, and you can look at someone, this person embezzled money from the firm, or this person preyed on women by engaging in multiple non-consensual sexual encounters, right? So we can talk about the bad things, and we can all agree, yeah, that's bad, we shouldn't do that, but we can't actually talk about the good things. We don't really have a good conception, a holistic conception of what character is. But I do think that Jensen's absolutely correct when he says, greatness comes not from intelligence, but from character, right? So the credentials that you have, congratulations, you're a Stanford student, you might get a perfect score on the LSAT or the GMAT or whatever. That is not greatness. Greatness comes from character. And second, and this is the really important thing that I want to clue in on for this conversation, is that greatness does not, the character does not come from intelligence or from training or from sitting in school or doing homework or, surfing TikTok. Character comes from difficulty, from pain and suffering, because that pain and suffering produces resilience. And I also think he's right to say that today, people who have credentialed backgrounds, people who are sitting there, they've had very affluent upbringings, they've had everything handed to them, or they've always had it easy because they're so intelligent, they're likely to be not resilient people, because resilience only comes from pain and suffering. I'm reading another book now. I'll probably have more things to say about it on a future podcast called The Anxious Generation by Jonathan Haidt. This is a brand new book, just came out a couple weeks ago, and lots of people are talking about it on the internet. Jonathan Haidt is a moral psychologist. He wrote the book, The Righteous Mind. He also wrote The Coddling of the American Mind with his colleague, Greg Lukianoff, I think is the last name. He wrote a book on happiness a while ago. I don't remember the exact title. But one of the things he says in this Anxious Generation book, which makes the argument that Gen Z is the anxious generation because of their dependence on technology and the way that we've constructed technology to in unprecedented ways and tried it out on young people's brains. And it's really fundamentally altered the way that they engage with the world around them. One of the things he says is that we have made this generation much less resilient by overly supervising their interactions in the real world and not supervising their interactions well enough in the digital world. And so I was thinking about that as I was listening to Jensen Huang talk about this as well, that resilience is what produces character. And if we don't have the situations, the pain and suffering to produce resilience, we will not get better. The third thing is that this really is a Catholic lens, I think, on things. I have no idea what Jensen Huang's religious persuasions are, but he's nonetheless articulating a truth that is recognizable to, I think, people across cultures and backgrounds and religions. But that is that these hard things are good for us. And, you know, contra the prosperity gospel that still flourishes in certain quarters of the U.S. today, the Catholic Church has never promised release from suffering. If you look at any of the accounts of the apostles, they all died a death of martyrdom or exile, and they did not have an easy life. So we've never been promised that life will be easy. We've, in fact, promised, you know, we've been promised by Christ the exact opposite, that life will be hard. But the upshot of that suffering is redemption, because that suffering produces endurance, right? So St. Paul has talked about this, the same sort of process that Jensen Huang talks about. It is through the suffering that we become better people. And that is a cause for rejoicing. So I thought that was really fascinating. Hopefully you enjoyed that as well. I'll stop there with a recap of the newsletter. I encourage you to go sign up. Go to creedal.substack.com. I will include a link in the show notes here as well, but I would love to have you sign up for this newsletter. It's free right now. And so I encourage you to sign up, and I, you know, I may turn subscriptions on at some point in the future, but for right now they're not on. So please feel free to sign up and get weekly things in your inbox. Another thing I want to share with you, I am starting to do more of the speaking circuit. So you can find more about that, or, you know, send me a note to come speak at your event, be that a parish event or an institution of higher education or a nonprofit or for profit, anything like that. I'd love to come to your event and speak. There's a list of topics that I've spoken about previously on my website. I will also link this to the show notes, and I'm happy to talk about any of those things or other things as well. And I'll work within your budget as best I can to make that happen. So please let me know if that's something that would be of interest to you. On a related note, there's a think tank called New Polity, N-E-W-P-O-L-I-T-Y. I will also link this in the show notes. But they're great. They're run out of Steubenville, where the Franciscan University of Steubenville is. Run by these guys named Jacob Imam and Mark Barnes, who are friends of mine. Now they're friends of mine. I just met them last fall when they asked me to do this. But if you poke around on their website, newpolity.com, you poke around and look at some of their essays and video courses and books, you'll see that they are thinking very deeply and very carefully about what it means to be someone who's pursuing human flourishing in 2024, when we have so many forces that are antithetical to our flourishing arrayed against us. And so they're asking provocative questions like this one, this conference running May 23rd to 25th, 2024. The question is, should we therefore destroy the servers? And so they're asking very hard questions about what does it mean to be a Christian or anyone who's pursuing human flourishing in a digital age. Do we have to just shut down everything? Do we have to become Luddites? Do we need to just have Wi-Fi free homes and no cell phones and just go fully analog? It's a good question. We should definitely talk about that. I will be participating in a debate against Mark Barnes, who is one of the founders of the New Polity magazine. And we will be debating the question of prayer apps and whether or not prayer apps are inimical to the spiritual life. I will be taking the nay. He will be taking the yay. We've talked about it. We actually have a lot of common ground on this, but for the purpose of the debate, I'll be taking the nay. I do think there are certainly ways in which prayer apps can be inimical to the spiritual life, but I also think that there are plenty of ways in which they are not. And I wouldn't be working for Halo, where I do work, if I was not convinced of that. So anyway, I would encourage you to check this out. If you'd like to come, I would love to see you there. May 23rd to 25th, 2024. Are the dates of the conference. It's conference price $195 based on this website here, but I'd love to see you there, and it should be a great time. My understanding is that none of the talks will be broadcast, so I think there's not a way for you to attend virtually or catch up after the fact. I think you have to be there in person to see it, but it should be a great time. These guys are doing great work, and I'm excited. You also hear some other great people. Matthew Crawford is fantastic. He wrote the books Zen and the Art of Motorcycle Maintenance, Shop Class of Soulcraft, and The World Beyond Your Head. I have not read the last of those three, but I really want to. It's on my list and I've heard fantastic things. D.C. Schindler, I don't know his work very well, but he's been recommended to me as one of the greatest Catholic philosophers alive today. So for what it's worth, I've heard really good things. I'm excited to hear more from him. Andrew Willow-Jones teaches at Steubenville, did his work in history at SLU. R. Arino's the editor of First Things. Alex Plato, I've corresponded with him in the past as well. He also is at Franciscan, teaches philosophy there. I already talked about Mark. And then Jacob. Jacob, like me, studied at Oxford, so we have that in common. And he's an economist by training. He focuses on the sort of ethics of investment and all of that. And then Ruben. I do not know Ruben, but I'm sure he's great. And he is involved in Steubenville, including the Steubenville theater scene, which is pretty cool. So anyway, I would love to see you there. Let me know if you're going to attend, and we can certainly make plans to meet up in person. All right, so that's that. I've got some links to share with you in the show notes. Please sign up for the newsletter. Think about coming to the conference so I can meet up with you in Steubenville, and let me know if you or someone that you know would like to have me speak at one of your events in the future. Until next time, have a great and blessed Holy Week, bright week. Until next time, God bless you.